And we are live. Welcome to the millionth episode of Benzinga Cannabis Insider. My name is Javier Case. I'll be your host today. Before we get into the news and our guests, AT, our producer, will roll the credits. Well, hello, hello, hello. Welcome again to Benzinga Cannabis Insider. As we continue to recover from the amazing conference that we hosted in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, we got a lot of testimonials coming in, people saying they raised money, they closed deals, they found new clients. Amazing stuff. We're already getting ready for our next event in Hollywood, Florida, April 16th and 17th of 2024. Go to bzcannabis.com. The tickets will never be more affordable than right now. I mean, if you get it now, you know, and you can't attend, you can change it for a different event. You can maybe even, you know, if not, like, resell it. We won't say anything, you know, for a higher price down the line.
You're going down a bad hole here, man. You're going down a rabbit hole. How am I sounding? How am I doing here?
Perfecto. Welcome,
Perfecto. Mr. All right. What up, Javi? What up, everybody? Do not resell your tickets. Ignore what Javier just... No, I'm just kidding. Just buy the tickets, right, Javi? That's the purpose. I will say, I do want to do an actual competition. Who likes Javi more? Who likes Elliot more?
Come on,
let's get some codes going. Javier's obviously going to win, but I at least want to make myself feel good. All right. Javier, man, it's good to see you this week. We missed on Tuesday, but glad to be back. What's happening, man? What's going on in the cannabis world? There's a lot going on.
As always, you know, we're still covering a lot of what happened in our conference. But first, Canopy Growth, CGC on the NASDAQ, Weed on the TSX. Great ticker, Weed. Traded up earlier this week after the company received its EU GMP certification. For those who don't know, that is a very hard-to-get certification. They got certified for their Ontario facility, meaning that they are now closer to being able to export medical cannabis to every market in Europe where it's available and the world. And again, you know, while Canopy is already exporting some cannabis to the European Union, the EU GMP is something necessary, right, to really commercialize any product really in the European Union at the pharma levels, especially, right? So very good news for Canopy. I think that's, you know, about it.
How are the markets reacting to it? How are we doing on the stock price today?
I mean, when they announced this was a couple of days ago when they announced it, the stock traded up considerably. Now it's giving up a little bit of the gains, right? And in the last couple of days, it's been trending downward a little bit.
As stocks do, rebounds galore. I feel you there, man. Awesome. Keep us rolling, man. I mean, I'll tell you one thing that was interesting. I saw an article the other day about how Verano, with this listing with Cboe Canada, is setting themselves up for a listing in the U.S. You know, however, Cboe in the U.S. doesn't list cannabis stocks. So it's interesting. I'm curious of your thoughts. Do you think this is near term or long term? Do you think they're getting a step up? Is the TSX a better go? It seems that there's some different opinions here. You know, we heard Curaleaf looking at listing on the TSX could be the next one in several months.
I like both exchanges, right? I think they have both been pretty cannabis friendly over the years, both the NEO and the TSX. You know, we'd have to check volumes. I think, you know, in terms of trading volume, maybe the TSX versus NEO, but I think the TSX has a little bit of a higher volume.
TSX, I feel like, is really, they did really well for Columbia Care in terms of getting them in front of institutions.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely the most liquid exchange in Canada, right? Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that is something that we've heard again and again. You know, people in the industry, especially those trading on the OTC down here in the US, They say, you know, it's great to be public. It's great for people to be able to invest, but there's not as much liquidity as we see in the New York Stock Exchange or we see in the NASDAQ, right? In that sense, the TSX has been a very good ally of publicly traded cannabis companies looking to raise capital or you know, move their shares and get institutional support. But you ultimately, you know, the big goal is always the big board, whether it's New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ. But I think NEO and TSX are great instruments for companies, you know, looking for public markets exposure while remaining compliant with all the U.S. laws and Canadian laws.
Great. Awesome. All right, Javi, we always talk about liquidity and capital markets. What's something fun that's happening in cannabis? You know, what you know, I want to get back to your product reviews eventually. I feel like, you know, we need some plant on this show outside of our background. But what's exciting you, man?
I mean, there's a few things that I'm excited about. One is the Ohio vote, right? The Ohio already started.
That's exciting. Yeah.
You know, the early voting is already underway, both for adult use cannabis and abortion rights. And so far, the turnout has been higher than expected, right? So we're thinking that this might pass. And if it does, this could tilt the entire scale for the country, right? As it stands, the proposal would allow adults over 21 years old to buy and possess up to 2.5 ounces of cannabis and grow plants at home, which is a very nice change of pace from many other adult use markets that are not allowing for home cultivation, pretty counterintuitively. And they would impose a 10% tax on purchases to be spent on administrative costs, addiction treatment programs, and social equity programs.
Especially. Phenomenal. Phenomenal. That's really exciting. Mm-hmm. Ohio, I know people have been very excited about that state. I think it was one of our top ceiling and potential states for the Benzinga Cannabis Capital Awards. So it's really exciting. And some winners for that state going rec. Keep an eye on, for me, Body and Mind.
And we lost Elliot, I believe.
I'm back. Just,
oh, you're back.
I'm back. BMMJ on the OTC. Body and Mind, they have a good presence in Ohio, and I'm sure there are several others, but you know, just to look at winners in that state like we did with Maryland.
Fantastic. We have great guests today. So let's do a rapid fire and jump into our interviews. Big
Hit
thanks
it.
To Trulieve Cannabis Corporation, TCNNF. They donated an additional $500,000 into Florida's ballot initiative seeking to legalize adult use cannabis. They have now donated more than $39 million, according to recent receipts.
Wow. That's phenomenal.
Love it. There's a new technology called QuantX Fungal that allows to test for yeast and mold in just 8 hours, which sounds like a lot, but it's very little for those who know anything about this. And then there's a couple of articles that I would like to recommend for after the show on Benzinga.com/cannabis. One is by Nina Steniak. She asks, how can dispensaries match the pretty darn good consumer experience the illicit market provides? We have 5 experts in the industry weighing in on this. So go check it out on Benzinga.com/cannabis after the show. And also an article by our new writer, Pato Little, that focuses on a conversation it had with Stony Point's co-founders, DJ Hoppa and Demrick. Very well known in the rap world. They have an amazing, very cool cannabis brand. And they were at the Benzinga Cannabis Capital Conference. So I had a very interesting conversation. Pato wrote a fun story about it titled From Beat to Buds, Stony Point's Hip Hop Journey into Cannabis Business.
Yeah, I got to say.
Benzinga.com/cannabis.
I got to say, so y'all, we always pump Benzinga one way or the other. I'm going to pump the news desk here. We're nothing without our news desk at Benzinga. The editorial team is phenomenal. And this new writer is Patricio, is his name, correct? He
sure.
is phenomenal. Go find his articles. He's quickly going to become one of the, I think, more well-known journalists throughout the U.S. cannabis space.
I hope so, man. I went out and found him and got him from another place.
He is so good.
Experience, like years of experience in economics and finance, knows the cannabis and other substances markets inside out, has dedicated a big portion of his life to doing harm reduction work in Latin America for substance abuse and substance use. So you know this content is going to be awesome. Only the best of the best for Benzinga Cannabis readers.
Ah, my man. All right, Javi, who do we got first? We have a couple really cool guests today. We're covering a spectrum of topics, but I believe we're starting more on the finance side.
Yes, sir. First off, we have Paul Dunford with Green Check Verified.
Let's do it.
Hey, guys, how's it going? How are you? I'm doing well. That was a super emphatic introduction. I feel like, you know, expectations are high. I got to perform.
They are. Yeah. They are. You got to deliver.
You don't perform. Yeah. Well, you're fired if you don't perform. That's it. Yeah. Paul, glad to have you here, man. You know, honestly, we've had Green Check Verified on before. A quick high level never hurts. You all play, I would say, a very effective middleman between banking and cannabis operators. But tell me a little bit about if I'm oversimplifying there.
No, honestly, you know, we try to be simple. The biggest challenge in cannabis banking is that banks don't understand there's a framework by which that they can bank cannabis without inflicting the wrath of the federal government. So half of what we do is education. I know I have kind of a goofy title, but that's what happens when someone gets to choose it, you know, unsupervised.
I was going to ask you, what is this knowledge?
It's because we know that educating financial institutions is how we get them into cannabis. So like, that's mm-hmm. literally my job, is doing education for financial institutions, removing the stigmas, you know, getting past all of our like baggage about, you know, if you grew up in the 80s, you know, like weed is PCP or whatever nonsense we were indoctrinated with. So it's bringing folks to where they can bank cannabis. And then because there are such high regulatory obligations, we also have software that helps them, you know, fill out the forms they need, get the transaction level information they need. It really is just about making sure that financial institutions know they can do this and do it in a way that meets their examiner's expectations.
Mm. Well, who are the most receptive institutions, right? And I'm not asking for names, but like, you know, we know that local banks and credit unions have been more open to banking cannabis than the big banks. But like, is any of that changing? Are bigger banks now more receptive? What's the scenario like there?
Yeah, you know, just as with cannabis in general, cannabis banking is full of myths and misunderstandings. So there is still, I think, this persistent notion that only the tiny credit union on the corner is able to do cannabis banking. And that might have been true a couple of years ago, because you know, the smaller the institution, the more nimble they can be. And if it's a credit union, they're really committed to the notion of serving the underserved and serving the community. So it's true, those were the ones that really kickstarted it. But now that we have this precedent over the years that you can do this without getting into trouble, we're starting to see big multi-state banks. You know, we have, I won't share names that aren't public, but there is a bank, Valley Bank, that's been public about doing this and doing it with us. They're in New York, New Jersey, Florida, Alabama. Like, we're starting to get big banks like that doing it. It's a slower ship to turn because there are so many levels of red tape and bureaucracy, but they're getting there. Just a little bit longer.
Well, you know, part of having a place to put your money is one part of this, but Valley Bank has also been a big provider of loans. Thus far, I think a huge $75 or $6 million loan to Trulieve. So having these businesses participate in all sides of the financial part of capital in this industry is going to be huge. In terms of the education part, you know, that's super interesting to me because education is something we talk about here often in a variety of different levels, whether it's CPG, how do you educate consumers on how to consume socially? How do you provide products and you know, let them, you know, just do it based off instinct? Or, you know, how do you educate people on wellness in cannabis, right? I feel like you need education on really every way cannabis can be involved in everyday life. How do you go about that from the financial side? And do you think it's much different from the consumer side and how companies should be educating their consumers?
It's an interesting question. I think the way that we have necessarily needed to work with financial institutions is to meet them where they are, as opposed to saying, like, you've got to get into cannabis, you're missing the boat. Like, you know, they have a journey they have to go through. You have to remember that these people have been told their entire careers that they'll go to jail if they touch marijuana money. Like, so it really is giving them the information they need. Like, there is federal guidance. There have been, I mean, we work with 140 financial institutions that are doing this. No one has been shut down by a regulator. No one's had their charter removed. Like, marijuana is not going to destroy your community. We see here, like, how it reduces, like, underage use of cannabis. Like, this can be a positive thing for you. You don't have to be afraid of being the weed bank. We had to fight that a lot at the beginning, was like, well, okay, but I don't want to be the weed bank. Like, my kids are going to get at school. Like, no, that's not a thing. This takes a while.
I like that a lot. I think the education part is something that this industry is still working on and figuring out. So getting different perspectives on how that happens it's necessary. I think I'd like to keep on that same through line, and then Javi, you can jump in. But the education part, when it comes to federal participants in the cannabis space specifically, SAFER, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and we've been chasing this for 8 years now. I think
10 years.
Maybe this is
there's
10
been
years
some
now,
version sorry, for 10 years.
Our yeah. 8th version of SAFE. That's what it is. it was in there somewhere. So we've been chasing this for 10 years. You know, here we are with SAFER, passed the Senate Banking Committee, looking at the Senate, maybe gets through the clusterfuck of a house that we have right now. But regardless, there's an opportunity here like we've not seen, mm-hmm. And participation like we've not seen. What does this mean for you? What does this mean for banks? What does this mean for the education of the financial side or the future financial side of the cannabis space?
Well, there is a really significant difference between SAFE and SAFER. And so one of the things about SAFE was people thought it did a lot of things that it didn't do and was never intended to do. Truly, what SAFE did was say, if you are a financial institution that is banking a state legal business, you will not be subject to the unwanted attention of the federal regulatory agencies, and that you would have to build an exam guide so that there's consistency in evaluating these programs for financial institutions. That's it. And that's incredibly valuable. I cannot overstress how incredibly valuable that would be to take that anxiety away from the people who are afraid of being the weed bank. Very important. But people thought that it would mean all of a sudden we'd get credit cards and we'd get investments in, you know, like social equity funds. And that's just not what it was intended to be. The thing that's great about SAFER, and I'm going to give credit to whoever drafted it, they actually listened to feedback from financial institutions and people who understood financial services, and they incorporated it. It is a strange example of something that has actually been adjusted and built to be the thing that people wanted it to be. So it addresses things like tribal cannabis, which has never been addressed except in that 2013 Wilkinson memo that's basically like, we're not going to go after you, haha, unless we want to, because of how we treat, you know, sovereign nations.
Unless we want. That is very reassuring.
Yeah, super reassuring.
It talks about social equity, but it even talks like deep cuts in banking, like the notion of legacy funds. So financial institutions, when they're approached by an existing cannabis business, they might have $1 million and they're like, I want to deposit it. And the financial institution's like, where does it come from? And so the SAFER Act actually includes kind of real niche provisions about, like, yes, you can accept legacy funds if they can demonstrate like the lawful provenance of them. It talks about insurance. It talks about financial services that go beyond depository relationships. And it doesn't make anyone do anything, but it does mention things like credit cards and debit cards. Mm-hmm. It calls out the players that have been kind of absent.
I'm sure we both have follow-ups, Javi, and I swear to God, I'll shut up. But just a quick follow-up. One of the issues with SAFE, and maybe this is what you're referring to, which is why I'm asking the specific question, was there was a Democratic senator that thought that there was an aspect of it that it was like a slippery slope for money laundering. And I'm curious, has that been fixed? Has that been taken care of? You know, whether it's heroin or you know, it's like it's like basically you do this, you know, then it leads to an argument that you could do this.
It's the gateway drug argument. And I think we know it's bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't know where this came. I honest to God don't know where this came from, because people are often referring to Section 10 of SAFER. Mm-hmm. And SAFE didn't say anything about, you know, it said that the financial institutions couldn't get in trouble, but it didn't say anything about you have to bank the industry. Like, that was one of the things about SAFE, was that it was opt-in. So it wasn't going to drag people who weren't ready. SAFER becomes more opt-out. And so what Section 10 says is that the federal government cannot require a financial institution to close an account or to exclude a class of customers or members. So there's this notion of like, oh, so the federal government can't tell you to shut down cartel accounts, which is nonsensical, because one, no one's saying that. And two, if you were to just read following in that section, it says, unless it presents some kind of threat to national security or something like that. So it's the ultimate fallacy of the gateway drug argument. And now we get it in banking.
You know, I want to close it up, you know, going back a little bit. You mentioned that SAFER would change how banks are scrutinized, right? What is, in reality, the scrutiny that the banks are receiving right now from the federal government? Because I see a bunch of banks banning cannabis and not getting into trouble, not having to incur in insane costs to do so. But maybe I'm wrong. Like, what is the current situation?
The reality is it is very costly to financial institutions. And I know on the other side of it, it can seem usurious, like, why am I paying you $500 a month? Well, the reality is that a financial institution makes a huge investment in compliance. Like, they are just as scrutinized as a cannabis business is. Where did this dollar come from? Where did this dollar go? You have to have those real transaction level insights to be able to demonstrate to your examiner that you're not facilitating the violation of like anti-money laundering statutes. So they often have to hire additional staff just to handle cannabis accounts. They have a lot of reporting they have to do. They have to file a report with the federal government every 90 days that all it does is say, yes, we're still banking this customer, times however many customers you have. So there's an enormous amount of paperwork that has to happen as well. So I understand how, you know, from the outside, it seems like, why am I being charged? If I was a pizza place, I wouldn't be charged. But the reality is there is a lot of investment that has to go on behind the scenes just to manage the data that they need to be able to show the federal regulators.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your insights. Paul Dunford is a co-founder and vice president of Knowledge. One of the best corporate titles.
Knowledge,
ever.
Yeah, 100%.
Only can compete with Chief Fun Officer for someone at Benzinga. I can't see who it is, but maybe you can figure it out. It's not me. Well, thank you so much for joining us at Benzinga.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too, my friend. Always good to get insights on what's happening legislatively, man. It has been.
I'm gonna.
It's
have
confusing.
To I'm gonna replay that this episode.
You know, it's confusing for a lot of people. Like, what's happening in Capitol Hill? What's happening with the DEA and HHS? And you know, having it simplified down is necessary for even the most involved and engaged people in this industry. Make sure you're continuing to read up on it, everybody. Javier is a great resource. Marijuana Moment, Green Market Report. Support your local industry media. You know, they are the ones that are really driving the awareness of this ship. With that being said, Javi, we ain't done.
We have another fun guest. Next up, joining us on Benzinga Cannabis Insider is Brian Gerber. He's the CEO of Hemper AT. You know what to do.
Brian G, back with us again. Guys. What up, brother? How are
That's you? A rapper name. I like that. Nate Dog and Brian G, gotta regulate.
How are you doing, guys? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, Javi just rapped. I hope you feel welcome. He only raps for people he loves.
That's
So Brian, last time we had you on, man, we really got a lot into Hemper, and it's been a while, right? So I encourage everybody to go back and listen to that episode. Really got a really good insight into what Hemper does, and the scale of what you do is massive. You know, and I think we can chat a little bit about that today. However, there's another side to what you do that we didn't chat about last time, and it's Hera Supply. Do you want to give us a quick update on what you're doing on that side?
Sure. So Hera Supply is the leading manufacturer of pre-rolled cones in the industry. We produce over 100 million cones a month for the market. We do all your big...
100 million.
Yes, 100 million. We're basically a solutions partner for the whole pre-roll category, right? So full customization, anything under the sun. It's not a one-size-fits-all model. We operate 14 manufacturing sites out of New Delhi, India. And we have about 4,000 employees working for us there creating cones. I don't know if anyone knows, but most cones are handmade today. We've been working on automation, but it's not as easy as it, you know, appears. And so,
wow.
So we've produced over like 3 billion cones since inception.
Wow, that's incredible.
I'm curious as to where's the demand, right? Like, is America smoking 100 million joints a month? I mean, and obviously a lot more than that, but...
Right.
Like, Javi, don't lie. Javi's got like 50 million.
are you really, like, are you selling 100 million cones every month? And like, where's the demand coming from?
For sure. So most of the demand is in the States. We do some in Canada as well, but mainly in the US. California being the largest market. And then I would say recently, Michigan's been great. Missouri's been great. Nevada has been great. All the, you know, newer markets, but most are going to California still. And we do some international. The cone demand is, it's everyone, the European and the like Australian markets, South America, it's roll your own is much bigger than it is here in the States. Nobody rolls here anymore. So that's been an interesting market to penetrate because it's not in the culture as laziness is here, you know? So everyone just wants to pack cones here and light over there. It's a much more, they like the process, they want to roll. So mainly
do it for us. Yeah, do it for us, Brian. That's what it's got to do. So, you know, pre-rolls are on the rise. We talked about it in our Chicago event, which if you were there, I hope you got to meet Brian. Best looking conference room in the game. I mean, and hopefully we get to showcase more products as we move forward because you guys have so many cool ones. But in regards to pre-rolls, it's growing. You know, the category has been a key word when it comes to cannabis products over the last several months. Tell me a little bit about where cones sit into making the pre-roll a quality product. How important is what you do to the growth of that product with consumers?
For sure. So I'll kind of take it back to when we first got into cones. So it was midway through 2017. There was a massive shortage in the market. And really, as you guys know, there's very little infrastructure in this industry for packaging and cones and manufacturing and just generally across the board, right? So really, we had to go figure it out and build it ourselves. And we didn't know if it was 100 million a month, 200 million a month, 300 million a month. It just kept scaling. So, you know, obviously the first year we were making 10, 20 million a year, that or 10, 20 million a month, then it turned to 30 to 40 million a month, then it was 50 million a month, and then COVID just exploded the pre-roll category, and we went to basically between 75 and 100 million a month. And a lot of that is, you know, trends from micro consumption for, you know, smaller dog walker joints have been picking up. The connoisseur infused market, you know, exploded. So, you know, with Jeter and Stizzy as some of our customers, it's, you know, they coined that entire lane. And basically everyone, I think the pre-roll category is unique because it's the quickest way for you to basically put yourself on the map, right? You know, people think owning a dispensary is the, you know, end all be all. It's not, you know, so we see all the time companies starting fresh, a new brand or someone coming in that, you know, has very little overhead, but a really cool brand or a new idea, you know, they, instead of using Keef, they're using THCA, right? Or something like that. And so I think for that, it's, you know, a monkey see, monkey do right now. But the guys that are innovating on the pre-roll category, coming to companies like us who can do glass filter tip products, blunts, you know, hemp wraps, basically a full customization, you know, portfolio, that's really where you can bring unique stuff to the market. But if you're just going to think throwing cheap cannabis in a cone and selling it for a dollar, it's not working anymore, right? It's, you know, people are looking for 0.1, 0.2, 0.3s. You know, the multi-packs are massive nowadays. I think that's been a rise in pre-roll popularity as well. You know, getting, you know, either multiple strains in one pack or smaller joints in, you know, a pack. That's really where the market's going. It's not, I want a one joint anymore, you know, once a day. It's, I want 0.1, 0.2 a couple times a day.
What is the hottest trend among these leaders in the pre-roll market? Is it the glass tip? What is, you know, the one thing that you see the winners here doing? And again, you know, this is not spilling the secret sauce. You can go to a dispensary and check it out. And also, again, it's all about innovating. You know, right. Someone already realized this. So, but what is the hottest trend right now in pre-rolls?
Yeah, so one of our big initiatives this year was pushing the glass filter tips. And so I think at the beginning of the year, we were producing maybe a couple hundred thousand tips a month. And then after Benzinga in April, we literally went from needing like 300,000 tips a month to over 3 million tips a month.
Wow.
So we actually ended up having to build automated machinery just to produce these tips in that quantity, because it's hard to hand make conical products because you're sitting there trying to form it and it doesn't work. So we had to go automated molds, basically. So we actually went to China for 2 weeks, manufactured machines, brought them to India, and started producing more of the glass tips for the cones. And so we do most of the blunt projects out there, you know, your cylindrical or your conical shaped, but that's really what's, I think, taking it doesn't add that much cost to your overhead. But what it does is it allows you to charge 2, 3, 4 times the regular price of a pre-roll. So I think people are gravitating towards that product because they know it doesn't really cost them much more to add it into their pipeline, but they can charge and make much more money.
Is there a future in pre-rolls? It doesn't sound like it, but I have to ask because I think in Chicago, you know, we saw a few brands that were talking about no cones on their pre-rolls. Why? Or like, what is it? Just lack of overhead? Is it, you know, are they creating a different product? Like what would be the purpose of not using a cone?
So you mean like a tube shape, kind of like a cigarette looking one?
Yeah.
So right now, I think the biggest hiccup to someone launching pre-rolls is the filling equipment, right? You've got knock boxes, which pretty much is the widest used machine in the market. Then you've got like STM Canna, which is like a step up from that. And then really your only option from there is a 250,000 plus automated machine, which nobody truly knows how that machine's going to operate, because you have, you know, if you go to Vegas where there's no humidity and you're running tests there, but that machine's going to end up in Florida, it might not run the same. And I don't think people are really thinking about this. So everyone's afraid to pull the trigger on these, you know, $200,000+ machines, because if it doesn't work, they're kind of, you know, shit out of luck, right? And so I think for the tube style, Rolls Pro Blackbird came out with a machine recently. And we actually produce a lot of the filter tips for customers who use that machine. So that comes into a tube shape in the end. And so for me, I'm personally more biased to the cone because I think it smokes better. And that's the way cannabis was meant to be smoked. It's physics, right? With the tube shape, I think they burn too fast. And so I'm not the biggest fan, but, you know, like I said, we're more of a solutions partner. Blackbird created the Rolls Pro machine, but then didn't realize, okay, where am I going to get millions of filter tips from for all my customers? So we actually, we make for Raw Gardens and a few other brands, and, you know, they buy millions of these tips every month, which were, you know, machine and hand making in India. And so I think a lot of people don't realize they have an awesome machine, but don't focus on where the components are coming from.
Interesting.
It's incredibly cool what you all are doing. And I think with the trends going the way they are, I don't think cones are in danger. I was just curious that, you know, I had heard of a few pre-roll brands without cones recently. I was curious what that is and if there was legs to it. But to be frank, it doesn't sound like it. But
the Ready Can popularized in Canada the cigarette style. And since then, and obviously Lowell Farms here in the States, you know, popularized it as well. And I think people think that could be the end where pre-rolls could go, but I think we'll always see tube style, cone style. I think it's just another SKU to have on the show.
100%. It's down to consumer preferences.
Yeah.
You know, switching gears a little bit, it's one of the things I'm always very curious about is the subscription box, right? And you know, I get the concept. And also it ties in a little bit to what you were talking about earlier, like just do it for me, like take the stuff for me, get it mailed to my home. But like, what's the demand for it, right? Why, who is the customer who wants to get a new bong every month, right? Even me, you know, I'm getting a bunch of samples and they're free. And at one point I'm like, yeah, I don't need any more bongs.
Well, not everybody's you, Javi, for one.
That's what I'm saying, even when it's free. But, like, there's an incredible demand, right? Like, other companies who are doing subscription boxes as well got acquired for multi-million dollar deals. So there's clearly a demand. I'm just trying to understand the demographic here. Who is buying this and what is the ultimate for goal sure.
So,
or reasoning?
What's your preference on consumption? Is it pre-rolls?
No, just rolling my joints.
Rolling your own joints. So
I'm from Argentina. That's why it's like, yeah, man, it's I will roll in 2 seconds.
I think there's like a culture in this industry where people love glass, right? And I think there's also a connotation that you smoke through a water pipe, it filters it out, it's cleaner, you know, something along those lines. And so I think people not only, so for our brands, for Hemper, for example, we turned a bong collection into a sneaker collection, right? So we made really fun products at economic price points. And, you know, you can only have so many beaker bongs, right? So we kind of got away from the $200 beaker bong, the 18-inch, 20-inch ones that everyone was using, you know, in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Really, I want something really tiny and compact that's easy to clean and it looks cute, more or less. And so for $29.99 a month, it's not, you know, a dollar a day, you're basically getting put onto a new theme or a new product. Yeah. Or, you know, we're basically the authority in dishing you the latest, greatest, right? And so we're probably one of the companies that's coming out with new stuff every single month, where most companies aren't. So we have the consumer's attention, right? We're posting about, you know, like I think this month it's the witchcraft box, you know,
yeah.
I think we've got the donut box, right? And, you know, we're just playing into the donor likeness, right? And I think that's really where we're winning. And in terms of the customer profile, it's everyone. Whenever we meet with marketing agencies, they're like, who's your target demo? And we're like, it can go from 21 to 60. Right. And it's whoever just falls in love with it. Right. You know, we had the Chinese takeout box a few months ago, and that's been one of our most popular. And a lot of the pieces look very organic. Right. I think our biggest thing is you're not embarrassed if it's on the coffee table, on your bookshelf.
Yeah, they look great.
Your mom sees it, your grandmother, your girlfriend. And that's the biggest thing. Right. They're super organic looking. So that's why people buy bongs every month.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, I'm looking at
kind of affordable too, right? Like, you know, if you look at the price point and the fact that you can order every month or every 2 months or every 3 months, right? And suddenly it's like you're not stuck with this like $150 a month subscription. No. It's like $40 and you just get it at home.
Right. And then, you know, the rule, every stoner knows 15 stoners. So you just re-gift them.
Touche. I mean, I'm looking at your marketplace right now, and hey, you have some cool stuff, as you're saying, the Indiglo, the Hydrology 9. I mean, these are some really nice looking products. But one thing I'm noticing is you have $500 products and $600 products, $200 products next to $25 products. and $20 products, right? So you have premium and you have affordable, all in one place here. Can you tell me a little bit about what do you see people buying? Like what data do you have there to show like premium products paraphernalia wise versus affordable products?
For sure. So our number one purchase product is the Hemper Box on the website. And then after that would most likely be our $50 bongs. So, you know, the Ducky, the Chinese Takeout, the UFO, that's predominantly what we're selling. It's either people buy into the subscription box, which is a great entry level, you know, affordable product, or, you know, say I subscribe to the box for a few months. I really just want this bong, you know, for myself or my friend or my roommate, whatever it might be. And so it's predominantly the lower tier stuff. And so that's been a theme of our kind of on our forecast of like new products to launch is we're really focused on like $20 and under, obviously, since kind of the economy has gone crazy. And so everyone's looking to save money, bunker down. So we're focused on $20 and under, but we do sell a lot of the 200 plus products as well. You know, the Puffcos, the Cryo Glass, even, you know, $60, $70, $80 products in the goodie series. So it's definitely a wide range, but predominantly I would say $50 or under is really where we're selling the most stuff.
Gotcha. That's very interesting. Do you see, I would say a mix of those buying the box that they come back as well for other things too?
Yep. So that's the whole idea about the subscription box. It's a Trojan horse marketing outlet, right? So we develop brand new products. We release it through the box. People get access to it if they subscribe. And then they find out, okay, I love the quick hitter product. And now I'm going to go on hemper.com and buy a whole box or a three pack or whatever it is. So the idea is to introduce you to stuff we've developed. And then you go on our website and purchase it, you know, in full size or in more volume.
Yeah, I'll highly recommend it. Hemper.co. Just hit the subscription box button there. I mean, it's really cool. You have some really phenomenal things on here. If you are a business looking for pre-roll cones, Brian's your man. But Brian, anything else you want to leave our audience with today?
If you need to contact me, brian@horrorsupply.com, and looking forward to helping everyone in their supply chain.
Appreciate your time today, my friend. Thank you for being here. Brian G, make it an exit Javier wrap, but thank you for your time. Thanks for working on all sides of this industry. It's needed.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Be well. Javi, that was fun, man. Two great interviews.
Trojan horse marketing thing in the chat.
I know, right? Trojan horse marketing. All right, Javi, we had a talk about Safer with a banking expert today, a VP of knowledge. More specifically, we chatted with a pre-roll and a subscription box marketing expert guru. I think we covered the gamut today.
Oh yeah. It was a great show, man. Honestly, a lot of takeaways for me, at least. I don't know.
Hope
the audience liked it as well.
Yeah. So, check out benzinga.com/cannabis for Javier, for Maureen, for Nina, for Helena, for Patricio, new amazing writer. The news desk is phenomenal. Keep an eye on this podcast. Share it with your friends. Let people know that we're here. We appreciate that support. That's the best thing you can do for us is put your friends onto us. One stoner knows 15 more. You heard it here. Each of you has to share this with 15 of your stoner friends. Until next time, Javier, last word to you, my brother.
I think we can do a contest, actually. Whomever brings the most friends gets something like a conference ticket or something. We'll think about it. I'll come back.
Whoever brings
the
most friends kind of gets a romantic night with Javier Haas.
I will do a candlelit dinner in Florida. No worries.
I'll be jealous of whoever does that. All right, candlelit dinner is on the line. We will see you guys again on Tuesday. Thanks again. Peace out. Peace.